Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you. Boom, I'm in the room. Good. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Ordinary People's Extraordinary Stories. Now I've got a fantastic guest on today. Now she's done a huge amount with her life. So what we're going to do, I'm going to drag her in and we're going to tell us all about her life. So January, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. I love that this is about a legacy and a story. Thank you for doing this for the future generation.
Yes. And it's all about your life. So if you can tell me where you were born, not necessarily when you were born because you're a lady, if you could describe to me what it was like, where you grew up, the schools you went to, and the education that you received. So
wow.
The platform's yours for a minute or two.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for that question. So my first earliest years was actually in the slums of the Philippines. My parents were of very, I would say, you know, limited means. And so I grew up, I remember I was 3 or 4 and my grandfather lived in the slums and I didn't know any better. I loved it. There was dirt everywhere. It didn't smell too good, but it was rich with joy and laughter. And I didn't know any better. And so that was sort of my earliest years. And as my parents grew up, I mean, sort of really gained, I would say, in their business and worked hard, we kind of moved into the next neighborhood, which was a little bit better. And then my parents put me in the best school. And that was their goal, even though they worked so hard and we barely had anything, you know, but they wanted me in the best school. And so I went to the best school and it was where all the wealthy people lived, but I was one of them. As a matter of fact, I didn't even have a living room. I didn't even know what a living room was when I was about 6 or 7 years old. We moved into this one house and my parents worked so hard as entrepreneurs. They're great. They're very generous people, but our living room was full of like 8 feet printing press, because that was their business. And all day I would hear the sound. Tuk, 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 tuk. They were creating papers because that's what their business was, and traveling to pitch to the government so they could sell and make money. And so, it was wholesome. People around me, you know, loved to laugh. There was a lot of singing, a lot of dancing. And I didn't really think anything about it until I grew up a little bit older and I realized, oh, there's a difference between rich and poor. And clearly we were not the rich people. But I didn't see it sort of as a bad thing as it was. I just looked at it as I wasn't and they were, and maybe someday we will. And so my parents then left for the United States so that they could have a better life for their children. So I didn't see them for 5 years straight. I was raised in those times around my families, my aunts and my uncles. And so there was some suffering there, I think, as a child, but really it remained a wholesome life. Philippines is a great place to be able to raise, I would say, children. And so I had a glorious time. It was simple. It was beautiful. It was rich. And then I came to the United States and my parents became nannies because that's the best way for them to get a. And so now it was very, you know, I would say simple means to now this billionaire took us in and created a mansion, an extension of her mansion into her house, and lavished us with so much. I mean, she would take me shopping for $10,000 a day. It was the opposite extreme. And so that was where kind of two different worlds collided for me. And I was trying to wrestle with, who am I as a woman? What do I do with everything that I have? What's important? And so there's so many things that in the world of materialism in the United States, I lost who I was. I lost sort of that joy and wholesomeness. I didn't think there was a lot of depth and meaning. And so sort of I fell into this trap where I didn't like who I was. I didn't like the woman I was becoming. I had no language for it. And so I was living the American dream. ninth grade, I was president of the school and homecoming queen. And from the outside, it looked like it was a great American dream story. On the inside, I felt like I was empty. And, even though we had more, I was less inside. And so when I went to college, I really looked for a place where I wanted a place where people had depth and meaning and people cared. So I found a college and I decided I wanted to study theology and philosophy. I wanted to study the richness of life. I wanted more meaning. So that became my journey. And then in that time, I also met a woman who mentored me and really taught me how to be a woman, because my mom, who was a great mother, great woman, she was an immigrant. So really didn't have a lot of, I would say, training on what is it like to be a woman. And so much of that I got all through my college years, which then led me to really ask the question, why is there no school to teach women how to be a woman in a world where so many women are hurting because they don't know how? And that became, sort of a journey for me. And my philosophy studies really led me to ask a deeper question. And so I started training women. And I still am. I'm still, 25 years later, 45 years old. I've been doing it ever since in college, teaching women how to be a woman in a world that I believe has devalued women. And now we have a school for women and it's practical life training and how to be a woman in a world that is now choosing to undefine us.
Wow, that went extremely quickly. Now, let's drag you all the way back, way back to when you was in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So, what's your earliest memories of school?
Great.
Can you remember your kindergarten days?
Yeah. So it was a very prominent school, and my earliest memories was I didn't belong there because it was. So big, but it wasn't big. It was prestigious. And my earliest memory, I would say, was, I went to this school and I had to learn Chinese. I had to learn English. I had to learn Filipino all at the same time. And there was a lot of fun. We did a lot of fun things as a little girl, a lot of joyful thing. There was no internet. There was really, so we played outside a lot. And that's some of my earliest memories. It was just wholesome childhood play.
Now, you mentioned that you were learning three languages, English, Filipino, and Chinese. Mm-hmm. I can understand English and Filipino, but Chinese? What was the Chinese influence in the area at the time?
So a lot of the Chinese influence really came because we were very close to China and a lot of the businesses came because it was better labor, I believe, at that time, as my recollection. So a lot of the wealthy people were Chinese. So there was great influence where a lot of people that are wealthy wanted their children to learn Chinese because it bettered the opportunity for business. So that was for a lot of the people. And say, let's incorporate now Chinese so that our children can actually learn how to develop business skills in Asia. So that was, and it was a very complicated language. I don't think I kept up with any of it, but I learned it since kindergarten all the way up to move to the United States, which is sixth grade, which is a pretty extensive amount of time. I can write
Chinese. Yeah, so write Chinese. Wow. I could barely use chopsticks.
Oh, there's 5,000 characters. We're 26. Can't write all of them,
it is a strange language, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So I can understand the English because that's like the international language of the world, sure. And an awful lot of Filipinos tend to go and work on cruise ships.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly my experience of being a cruiser. I've seen lots and lots of Filipinos working on a cruise ship. So, and they all speak very good English. Certainly the ones I've come across, and there's a lot.
Yes, there's a lot. Mm. And they choose to keep their family so that they could actually have a better living. Kind of pretty consistent.
Yeah. Mm. So moving up then from kindergarten, what about your elementary school? How was that? Were you still in the Philippines for that?
Yeah, I was still in the Philippines till about sixth grade. And so, you know, my elementary days, I would say, had an incredible group of friends. We did a lot of things. We had a lot of freedom because you could do a lot of things in the Philippines because it was a kind of a close proximity. So I went island hopping. We always went on adventures, caves, diving. I mean, we went mountain. I mean, it was just rich with nature. That was what I remembered it. And, you know, I could, in the Philippines, it was typical that you had a driver. And so I lived in a very sort of wealthy area. And even though we weren't wealthy at that point, but we had a driver. And so we could just say, let's go island hopping. And we would go there and we would have the local food and you just go rent a boat and you go from island to island. And that was part of, you know, part of what you did. But also I was sort of living in this both worlds because my, I had a lot of families that were poor. And so I went to a lot of the poor places in the Philippines and there were poor markets and I loved it. I loved it. I loved the fact that, you know, you could buy fish on the side of the road and you could eat at the fancy restaurant. There was just that experience. I was able to experience so much of the gamut as an element, you know, in elementary. And quite honestly, Tim, it really made me think about life in a more deep way because of the experience that I had. And so much of it, because my parents were gone, I had to think about life, what I wanted, what I didn't want. Suffering causes us to do a little bit more thinking. And it leads to gratitude. And I think that was, you know, for me, a real gift that I had as a child. I had no one. I had to think about my life. I had to fend for myself. And I was very grateful. I would never be who I am right now without the privilege of the struggles that I had in the Philippines.
So talking of struggles then, how did you get on at school? What was your elementary school? What was your favorite lessons? What was the lesson that you just want to get up and get to school for?
Oh, that's a great question. I loved science. I loved learning about the plants and the stars and the wonders in the world. I love learning also kind of social studies, which touched on cultures and geography. That was just something fascinating about the different parts of the world for me. So those were my favorite subjects. And we live the kind of education that we had, it was not your standard education, you know, where you give a test. It was slightly Montessori in some degree, but really you had to do your own research at a very young age. You could go on your own pace. You sort of had lectures, but you could go further on your own particular interests that, you know, it didn't have to be the same for everyone, which I thought was great. Because then I felt like it wasn't a one size fits all and I could go deeper in the things that I wanted to go deeper in. I remember studying more about chlorophyll. I was fascinated by it. And some of the countries. And so I could. And I think that was also something that was very different when I came to the United States.
So what lesson wanted you to have a duvet day and not bother going to school? What one did you really not like?
Oh, gosh.
A particular lesson that yes, you just didn't want to attend.
Penmanship. I had to rewrite things over and over again because you were taught the discipline of repetition. And I had to rewrite my penmanship. And it was non-negotiable. Like in America, your penmanship was forever, you know, but there it had to be in a straight line and you had to be so precise. And it was not my favorite. But it's
so something like, I must not talk in class. I must not talk in class. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, over and over. And I was talkative in class. This is really interesting. So when I was in kindergarten, when you talk, and I was like a talker, I wasn't a bad kid. I just really loved people. And we had wore slippers when you walk in the school. But if you're talking, they get to teach you. You had to take your slippers off and put it in your head as a punishment. And the reason why I do that is because then you can't turn your head. And so I still found a way to turn my head. And, you know, I felt like I always had a slipper in my kindergarten class because I always talked. And so part of my memory was my pink slipper on top of my head because I just talked to people.
Well, you can always take a positive out of that. and now teaching the deportment.
That's right. It gave me great confidence.
So let's move on a little bit. Let's have a look about when you moved to the States. Mm-hmm. So whereabouts did you move to, and what was the reason for that?
So I moved to Maryland, which was where my parents had worked for this lady who had two children, and that's, they were nannies. And so I went to the public school that was there and started out as a sixth grade. But because I knew English, I transitioned really well. And they put me actually into this ESOL class. If you were somebody that wasn't from the United States, from a different country, and they were very surprised that I spoke very well English, even though, I had obviously an accent. But I had a head start because I knew English so well. I've been studying it for almost a decade.
Mm. Yeah, that one's really good. So I guess Chinese wasn't spoke that often.
No, it was not. I was glad to actually not have to, in our elementary school, you had to have a card in front of you and you could only speak those three languages. You could speak English, Chinese, or the native language, not my dialect. I spoke a different language. And so if they catch you, you get in trouble. So it was a very strict school. I didn't really, it was strict school. I didn't think it was a bad strict school. It just really taught you discipline. I appreciate discipline.
So the school in Maryland then, and you'd say you transitioned fairly quickly. And how was your level of education compared with the kids you were up against when you went there? Were you behind? Were you in front? Did you struggle at all?
No, I was actually my first 2 years I was a straight A student. I don't think I studied because the rigorous education that I got in the Philippines sort of bought me time to transition. It was not difficult except for the writing part because of the grammar. I didn't learn English grammar or I guess the grammar that we had in the Philippines is sort of slightly different, or it wasn't sort of up to par. So that was the challenging part initially, but really I didn't, I was a good student and I got straight A's.
So again, what was the favorite subject? Was it continued with the sciences, or did you pick up a different subject that you really liked doing?
I would say, I think I continued on with social studies, which is understanding the culture. I really kind of took a turn to that because I was obviously an immigrant. So I appreciated just understanding the lay of the land, what it's like to transition. I think that's kind of where I gravitated to.
Was there any classes that you didn't like doing?
Yeah, maybe English. I didn't know. I mean, not because of the grammar. And I wasn't really good at the actual written language. And I felt like I struggled with it but it was deceiving because I spoke it really well, almost to a point that I didn't really have an accent. So, but I think I missed learning it in the United States. And when I came here, they had already learned so much of the language and the grammar that at sixth grade I came in, I never got the grammar training that I needed. Everyone else did. Yeah. And so it was a struggle just because I really didn't know how to write, the grammar grammatically, I would say English grammatically.
Yeah. So did you do any other subjects like the arts? Did you play music?
No, sports? But I really loved home economics because we had sewing and then we had woodwork and then you could cook and you had to cook for the whole class. And I appreciated that because it was beyond the academic work. And I always thought that education needed to be beyond the academic work. And I felt I was able to sort of use those really well, sort of in everyday life, which I appreciated.
Mm. I don't think they do that with schools nowadays, do they? They don't do the home economics. I mean, when I went to school, which is an awful long time ago, the girls did like sewing and cooking, mm-hmm. And the boys did metalwork and woodwork, and never the twain should meet. Nowadays, they went through a period a few years ago where boys could cook and girls could do metalwork and stuff like that. Nowadays, I don't think they have those classes in school because of the, I think, health and safety. And when kids around lighted fires and might burn themselves. Yeah.
Well, I don't. Yeah, I think that's a robbery because today children have become so incompetent that they are incapable of some of the most basic foundation. And it's such a foundational skill that helps you layer those diamonds. And, you know, I train thousands of women across the globe who have no, you know, and a lot of them suffer because they just have no basic kitchen skills. Forget cooking. That would be an upgrade.
Yeah.
Just a big order, cleanup, preparation. Everything feels overwhelming when you're underskilled. And then it becomes a compounding problem because then you've never also taught how to organize your home, how to manage your mind, how to figuring out, you know, how, what you want in your life. Just one hardship after another. And I just feel it's unfair and unjust because we have almost reached the heights of education without the foundation, which is crumbling.
Yeah.
You know, it's
I think they're missing a trick. And it's globally. It's not just one country. It's not just America. It's not just Europe or the UK. It's everywhere.
Hmm.
And I think people are losing skills that we used to have.
Yeah, you're right.
Which is a great shame.
Yeah, and it used to be common sense, and you know, and common sense has now become common practice because we don't practice any of these things. And
yeah. They don't like people with common sense nowadays. It's not a thing to have.
It's really sometimes shocking some of the things that people do and think maybe they never thought of what they're thinking. There's not even a thought of consequence of your words, of your action, being a man of your word, being a man of integrity. All these, I would say, foundational character. And people achieve so much but have so little interiorly.
Mm.
And you know, what good is it to gain the world and lose yourself in the process? Because you literally don't know how to communicate to the people around you. Basic courtesy. If you go to American school, I don't know what it's like in England, but the children are on their phone. They don't know how to say hello. I have 8 children and I have teach my children some of these foundational communication skills that I am very fierce about because it's so important and it's so basic that if they don't have it, it will rob them of opportunities. But see, there's no reinforcement because when they go to school, when they go to their peers, nobody's saying hello. Just the common.
Well, they text each other, don't they?
Yeah. I don't put up with it. I say, well, you can't graduate from my house without learning basic courtesy skill that's going to enhance the quality of your life in the future. And so mothers. But see, if you are a mother and you also lack the discipline, how could you discipline your children?
Yeah, I think it's a problem that we're going to see more and more as the years go on, where the generation aren't being taught that. So that skill's lost and it's just...
Yeah, I think there's a newfound hunger for it, Tim. I do believe it just because I'm on the forefront of this battle. I am seeing women, men becoming more aware of this crisis and saying, wait a minute, we can't continue this road of, you know, demise. Essentially, we're burning ourselves alive. And so I think there is a newfound hunger for depth, for meanings, for some of these skill set. The problem is that where do you go to access it, which is a reason why we have the school for women, which is not just, you know, it's not just skills about practical life. It really skills about how to expand your life in every part of your life. And that to me is, I think, the crisis of our culture is a foundational crisis of how to be human.
Hmm. Anyway, let's take you back to what about your high school? Moving on to high school. How was that for you?
It was a great experience up until my end of my junior year. I excelled. I had great friends. Education to me, I was also a straight A student. Most of the time, I think every semester, you know, you might have a. So that was great. At my end of my junior year, I think I started to ask some painful questions of, can we do something meaningful with our life? And I felt like the kids that I surrounded myself with, they're good friends, but they also lack, I think, the depth. And so it was fun until it wasn't fun anymore, my junior year.
So what about your senior year? How was that?
It was hard because I began to think about my own life, my purpose, why I'm here, the legacy I am leaving. I asked the hard question as an 18-year-old woman. And what I did was I pulled away from my friends because I realized I was the only one asking it. I was either going to be influenced by the shallowness and the lack of depth, or I was going to go find other people who were asking the same questions so that I could find the meaning. And so I pulled away. I was very absent in my high school years, but I was very present to myself. Mm-hmm. So those challenging senior year actually became a great gift in my life.
Mm. So you mentioned earlier that you was the homecoming queen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was homecoming. I think my junior year. I think.
All right. So they didn't go on to the senior year then.
No. They have a junior and then senior. I didn't even go to my senior year prom.
Oh, you missed out on the prom. I was going to ask about the prom.
Yeah.
So you didn't even get a corsage.
We had it. There was a dance every year. And so I went to the dances. And then my junior year, I was homecoming queen. But my senior year, I had no desire.
Hmm. So what about, what did you do after you graduated from high school?
I went into my college years and I, at that point, found a great school. I felt like there was a lot of depth and meaning. And then I started really developing a relationship with God. I wanted to understand who God was. I wanted to understand who I was in the place of God, my place in this world, my purpose. And so I decided to study theology and philosophy simultaneously. And I loved it. I loved learning about philosophy. I think I even loved it more than my theology class because it's a study of what you're thinking and it's a study of all the studies. And so that became, I would say, a new love for me and learning some of the layers of wisdom. So my college years were exciting. It was the best. And I can't say it was the best because I'm living my best life every year. I turned the corner, I would say, in my college years. And I felt like I was kind of going the wrong way my senior year. And my college years, I began to have, I began sort of that little girl in the Philippines who appreciated life, who had quality. And that was my turning point, was my college years. And so I really loved it. And I found quality friends. My education was rich. And I found myself in college.
So where was the college?
It was in Ohio. It was not a very pretty place. It was cold. The water was not. It smelled good. The town itself was not very pretty, but there was a city on the hill. They called the school, and that was a kind of a special place for a lot of people. So people went there actually for the school, but we never really left outside of the college campus. The campus itself was so rich with joy and laughter and dancing, and it was wholesome. And there was really no need. I went to school abroad. My sophomore year. I can't remember. Yeah, I think maybe it was my sophomore year. And I did a semester in Europe, in Austria. And I got to travel all around Europe, including England. I went there actually by myself. I traveled and decided to go by myself and venture out. So I loved it.
So how did you get on in Austria? Because they speak a different dialect of German.
Yeah. So yes. So
were
there was
you able
a school
to communicate, or was there an international school using the international language of the world?
Yeah, it was a campus of our college, so everyone spoke English.
All right.
So it was a campus, an extension of our campus. It was in Gaming, Austria. It was right outside Salzburg, I believe. It was about outside. So you'd ride the train there, and it was this town frozen in time behind the Alps. And it was just stunning. So I loved it. I traveled all every Brilliant. Weekend. We traveled somewhere. And that
you
was
You went somewhere every weekend.
Yeah, well, we did. And they did a 40 class and 3 days they wanted you to travel. And that's what we did.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So how long did you spend in Europe?
Almost 6 months, maybe 5 months, January to all the way to May, whenever the semester was done. So I covered a lot of grounds.
So what did you do when you finally graduated college?
I worked, first I did some volunteer work on understanding. I studied women. I really wanted to focus my education on women. And then I landed in working in Capitol Hill for a congressman and worked in Congress for almost 4 years as an executive assistant of a Florida congressman. And I learned a lot there. Put my theology education right into the heart of politics. Let me tell you, to see all of the politics and theology or what?
So we won't go down a politics route, I don't think. We'll stay out of politics. It's too toxic.
But you know what's so interesting? When I was there, I wasn't very political. I had a group. My job was I was executive assistant, so I learned a lot. But it really, I don't even really think I understood politics the way I'm understanding it now. So, and I would also say that in those time that I was there, I don't think it was quite as divisive as it is now. I think there was, it was a different culture then, or maybe, it's sort of, I was sort of preserved in the way I was thinking about it. So it wasn't really until my later years that I had kind of studied a little bit of the influence of politics in all areas of culture. But when I was there, it was just an adventure to me. I learned a lot. Mm.
So what did you do after that?
What did I do after that? So I got into real estate, and I tell you, I found my best real estate, which was my husband. I went to my real estate my first year. I met him my first day, and then we were engaged in 6 months and then married in another 6 months. And then I never really practiced it because then I got pregnant with our first child soon afterwards. And then it was just, I couldn't really do it simultaneously. And then I had 4 children in 4 years. And so it really, I really couldn't work, nor did I sort of want to. My mental space was there. And so he built his business while I was home with the children. But the same, I was still training in women. I would still do conferences. I would create classes for them. I never lost my love for teaching women.
Hmm. And that's continued through the years then?
Oh, yeah. I just felt like I always had a dream to build a school for women. When I graduated college, I drew a school and it was a dream. I thought, women need a school. We need to show women how to be a woman. And I've never imagined that statement could be as relevant as it is now. And so that was a dream I kept in my heart and I just kept at it. And then it was 10 years ago, my husband said, January, do you want to reach thousands or millions? And I said, millions. And the reason why I was so passionate about it is because nobody ever showed me how, and I suffered for it. And so I felt like my legacy is that what I endured, I hope that I would give women tools so they don't have to endure and rob themselves of the gift of life that I never received. So that is so much of my passion.
So you've learned the hard way. And there's always two ways to learn, obviously. There's the easy way and the hard way. And most people generally choose the hard way.
Yeah. The hard way, it's right. But a lot of times you don't know what you don't know. That you need to know how to value yourself. What does that look like? What does it mean to value yourself? What does it mean to respect yourself? What does it mean to be in command of your emotion? What does it mean to take care of you? I mean, all these things we hear all the time, but really, who's showing us how?
Yeah. So that's what you do. You show women how
to be a woman.
How to be a woman. So what's your basic curriculum that you sort of set for these ladies? How'd you go about it in the first place? I mean, do you assess them on what they know and then build from that? What's the process?
I've been teaching women for 25 years, and so I've really created a system through this year. So we have a signature course that's 16 weeks, but I go through it where they start with assessing every what we call arena, which is part of their life. There's 8 parts of a woman that we've just divided. And then what I do is that they really assess themselves in every part of their life all throughout the course. And we have learned sort of the most genius model to teach women is actually through a group, small group setting with a coach and a course with a committed time, start and finish. And so it's typically about 6 to 8 months. They go through the course with a group and a coach. And then I've presented to them these 16 classes, which is essentially about 64 lessons. I take them through an assessment. Every lesson has an assessment. I start them understanding. I teach them how to discover their purpose. I teach them how to discover their wounds. I teach them how to discover the desires of their heart, how to dream as a skill, how to plan, how to manage their mind, how to design the woman they want to become. And then I teach them how to have friendship, how to honor their mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual health. I give them all the practical tools, and I give them how do you develop skills to be in a relationship? What does it mean to communicate effectively? What does it mean to honor your value in a relationship? I teach them how to manage their home, how to design it, not just physically, but also how to really create an inspiring place. I teach them how to discover their work, what they love, how to use their strength and their talent to use it for the purpose. I teach them how to design their home life. What is it like to create an infrastructure and a standard at home? How to build wealth that's not just limited on money, but time and your resources. So I give them all the how-tos on all those different arenas. So even though it's 6 to 8 weeks, they have assessment, they have homework, they have the classes, they have coaching, they have a community. All of that sets them up really to begin the foundation. But really, the women that take our course take it 6 and 7 times, that one course alone, because there's so much depth. Mm-hmm. And I'm teaching the frameworks and formulas. And so, you know, when you think of Einstein, you know, when you think of all these formulas that have lasted time, it's replicable. So the course that we have, it's replicable. Any woman can take it with 13 all the way up to their 80s taking it, because they can take a formula on how to rewire the limiting belief or how to manage your mind, and they can use it, their daughters can use it. And so that's really the school that we're creating, is a replicable formula on how to be a woman in the world that perhaps has devalued women. And I think it's you know, the thousands and thousands of testimonies have been a fruit. It shows the fruit of, I would say, the work. And it's women that are doing work. Was giving them the formulas and frameworks.
So is it all done online, or is it? Do you have a campus where they come to? Is it a mix of both?
It's a mix. So there is no campus. Everything is online because we live in an online world. But some women do it what we call live, where they meet live because they prefer it. It's a group of 8, 10, 20 women. They have a coach, or they can do it online. And they usually meet every other week. They take one class, they meet and discuss it. They have homework, and then they go to the next class. They, you know, do their homework and then discuss it. So they go through it as a journey. And I feel like that's, you know, I used to think about 25 years ago, we really need an infrastructure school for women, but I never imagined the internet would actually allow us to have a school for women without having a physical infrastructure. The biggest department store in the world is Amazon, and they only have a warehouse. Mm-hmm. There's no physical forefront. And so that's our vision, and our dream is that we want our school for women to be used in every home, in every woman's home, and give them the resource that they need that's not available in our current infrastructure and society.
So how would a woman get in touch with you in the first place? How do you market yourselves? How does a lady find you to be able to start that process?
Great. They just go to thewomanschool.com, and they can start. They have a wholeness quiz, which is an assessment. It takes them to sort of some questions, and then we set them up with our team member to start actually thinking about every part of their life. And then they decide, I love it, and we set them up with a coach and a community. So just go to thewomanschool.com and we set it all up for you.
Fantastic. So is it purely just for women or can blokes do it?
We have a man's school. And that was because the women were asking for it. Mm-hmm. So we actually, when I started doing the school for women, when I launched it, women were so moved and transformed that they said, January, how can I build a business around this one course? So my husband said, great. You know, let's build a business. So now I'm teaching with about 300 plus coaches all over the world. And we're only 4 years old, roughly, that are building a business based on this one course. So if any, you know, woman out there or any man out there say, I want to facilitate a group of people, we teach them how to do it. And see, they don't have to be an expert coach because the course actually teaches them for them and they just facilitate and walk people throughout the journey. So it's both for men and women. And then there's also for those that want to build a business around it, which is the coaching part.
Oh, brilliant. So you've been working on this for the last 25 years and it's finally come to fruition and it's just picking up momentum all the time then.
Well, I've been teaching one for 25 years. However, we just launched the school officially 4 years ago. So we grew from zero to 40 plus countries in just 3 years. And so I was doing it for free. I didn't charge a dime. I just believed in it. And then what I realized, when people don't pay, they don't pay attention. So when people invest and invest in themselves, they actually invest the time and energy to commit to their own growth. And it doesn't matter how good anything is unless women or men are willing to commit and growing. And that's what we realize. And, you know, when they invest in themselves and there's a community, there's a coach, I mean, you have exponential transformation simply also because the courses that we offer them is really a how-to course. I teach dreaming as a skill set. You know, I teach effective communication skill. I break it down in layers of skills and they've got their frameworks and formulas and thousands of scripts in our courses. So they really have a lifelong, I would say, course in their hands.
Yeah, I've seen that in the past where if something's for free, it doesn't matter. But if you've had to pay for it out of your own hard earned, then it means something. And I think that's, and it doesn't matter how much it costs, but you've invested in it. And so you've got a vested interest in getting on with it. Whereas if it's free, well, I can't be bothered today.
Yeah, but you know, the more actually people invest in it, the more money they invest in it, the more they actually value it. And that's true across the board. You know, you buy a cheap old bag that you spent $2, you'll treat it like a $2. If you buy a fancy bag that costs $200, you'll actually take care of it more. And that's just human nature. And so, you know, we had to price it to a point where you know, you want to be able, you're committing your time and energy to it because our goal is so that you actually make the time for you. Otherwise, you know, they really won't because there's a million things distracting us in our culture today, a million things. I mean, you know, I often think of these grandmothers who are great cooks and their granddaughters or their daughters don't know how to cook. Why? Because even though they're next to them, they're not doing
because they've done it for them. and then the grandmother won't let it go.
Really? And then how can we pass on the legacy of those beautiful recipes?
Absolutely. Right? Unless the grandmother teaches them how to do it. Yeah,
we have to. And so we have to teach some of these basic skill set of focus and concentration or role modeling or asking questions. Or I would say, you know, creating an infrastructure where you actually can have time together in conversation. I mean, you get put people together, they don't even know what to say to each other. They have no conversation skills. You know, where it used to be that you could go deep with people and laugh with them and talk to anyone because that's what you did on the front porch. That's just the courtesy. That was the standard then, Tim. Now there's no standard. Yeah. You could berate somebody on the internet, nobody would hold you to it. Because that's the norm. Yeah. We've lost a sense of humanity, and that's got to stop. We can't continue this demise. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, the loneliness is an international epidemic. I mean, isn't that frightening to think of in a world that's globally and hyperly connected? The mental illness, the marriage, everything is literally, I mean, they have a data right now that in spite of all the freedom that women have achieved in the West, women are actually unhappier today than they were 100 years ago.
Yeah, and that's a fact.
And that's a fact.
And
why is
there's not a lot you can do about it.
Well,
and I think it's just, technology's had a lot to do with it. The way that we've moved forward.
So fast.
Sometimes, I mean, we go back 100 years. We don't even know to go back sort of 40 or 50 years. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have mobile phones. We had call boxes on the side of the road that you need to do.
We had a bell, you had to come in.
And people had to talk to each other. Nowadays, you pick up a phone, it's got more power than the rockets they sent to the moon.
It's
just technology has ruined people, I think.
Yeah, but I can't. There's a part of me that's saying, well, we have to learn how to live in this new kind of world. In a new kind of world, there's new skills that are necessary. The skills that maybe our grandmothers didn't need to learn, but the skill of brevity, the skill of conversation, and where you have to go deep fast because there's just not a lot of time. The skill of managing our tonality, where we talk to people, eye contact. I mean, it's sad to think, Tim, that we have to reteach it, but we have to reteach it. You don't have to go far in an education system right now. Go down to the local high school. Eye contact, one-on-one skills that opens doors of opportunities for you. Kids don't know. And I know that because I have children and I am on it with them. But if our world doesn't enforce it, and that's why, to me, it has to be a grassroots effort of training this generation and next generation. We can't save it in politics. We can't save it externally. It has to be an interior grassroots. Every woman on deck that's saying, you know what? I need to learn how to be a woman again. Otherwise, I'm going to suffer. And
future generations will suffer.
Yes,
and that's a sad part of it. And you're seeing it day on day now, where people aren't, they're so wrapped up in themselves. They don't see the wider picture. They don't see the wider world. They're glued to these things day in, day out, and
they're a slave.
Losing that communication skills that we always had and missing out on so much.
So they're literally a slave. And think about this. I love this. Be a man of your word. We didn't need contract by 100 years ago. Think about what that sounds like right now in the internet world. Oh, sure, I'll be there. Oh, sure, I'll do that. There's no sense of character, integrity, honor. I mean, where is that now? We have, we've devalued the word of a man or a woman. And so I'm fighting against it, because if you don't honor your word as a man or woman, you will suffer. You will be untrustworthy. Yeah. Nobody's going to want to be around you. And then all of a sudden you're going to realize, why am I lonely? I don't like my life. I hate my life. Nobody wants to give me a job. Well, your character has everything to do with your job.
Absolutely.
That's our legacy.
Well, January, I wish you every success in your endeavor.
Likewise. Thank you, Tim. I appreciate it. I really am so grateful. Thank you for the opportunity here to speak my heart. I get passionate about it. Fiery, as my husband would say.
It's been fantastic. I've loved every minute of it. And it's been very, very interesting.
Thank you.
Where do you see yourself going in sort of the next 5 years?
Oh, it's a great question. Really fighting the culture war. My dream is to have this masterclass in every home, in every woman's home, so that it can be in every woman's heart. So that's my goal in 5 years, is to get us into 1 million students. And I think that creates a ripple impact in society. I've got a book that I need to write. I wrote a book last year. got to write a new book. I'm launching a class. It's called The Rise of a New Woman. What is the kind of woman that we need for such a time as this? And so that's in it. And that, a lot of speaking, I think, in the next year or two, now that my baby's 3 years old. I have a bit more time to travel. But yeah, I'm fighting the culture. I'm fighting for, I'm not giving up, Tim. I can't give up on the next generation. My children are young and I have to fight for them. I have to fight for the women who want so much more out of life but don't know how to.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's been fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tim.
Wow. What a fascinating story. If you want to learn, and it's not just for women, it's for men as well, to learn those new skills, just find the details down in the description, contact January, and good luck. So until the next one, TTFN, ta-ta for now. Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you.